This week, the Dow Jones Industrials rebounded 164 points on rumors of an impending solution to the government shutdown and debt ceiling. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, with you on this October 11th broadcast. We have another all-star lineup. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke's successor was announced this week. Dr. Janet Yellen will take the helm at the Federal Reserve as the first chairwoman. James Turk and I discuss the implications of the changing of the guard. Plus, we delve into the gold backwardation story. Gold has been backdated only twice since the bottom in 1999. Both times marked key launchpad moments. Just a few weeks ago, gold entered backwardation for the third time. James Turk says this virtually guarantees an explosive move is in the cards. If history is a guide, the event could take gold to its inflation-adjusted 1980s peak of $2,400. Then Gerald Celente and I discuss the ramifications of the debt ceiling and government shutdown. Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report. It's not hyperbole to say that we have one must-listen-to program in store for you this weekend. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the Market Weatherman Report. Partly sunny skies persisted over the precious metals exchanges for the second week running amid continued political rancor on Capitol Hill. The government shutdown persisted in its second week with no solution on the table. Still, investors expect the debt ceiling to be raised, lessening some of the appeal of safe haven investments. By Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was near the break-even point but shed about $40, ending at $1,272, and silver dropped 40 cents for the week, ending at $21.34. Gold is currently backdated on the NYMEX exchange in the October 2013 through June of 2014 contracts. Although hedge funds doubled bullish positions on gold, according to the U.S. Commodities Futures Trading Commission, investors took some profits off the table this week amid news that U.S. legislators are nearing an agreement to increase the national debt and end the government shutdown. The president and the U.S. government have about a week before the borrowing authority runs out of cash. House Republican leaders appeared close to extending government borrowing authority but remain undecided regarding the current government shutdown, now in its 11th day. Nevertheless, traders are confident that the U.S. lawmakers will avoid default and raise the U.S. debt ceiling for the 8th time in 20 years. Another top story impacting the precious metals this week was the appointment of Dr. Janet Yellen as Federal Reserve Chairwoman. The nomination of Yellen is likely to result in further quantitative easing. The Fed and government continue to pass the hot potato back and forth. Wise market watchers know that eventually the spud will be dropped to the delight of precious metals investors and the dismay of most other asset classes, sending gold to the inflation-adjusted price of at least $2,400. So at least another $1,000 from current levels on the upside, and perhaps even 2 to 3 times that number. Silver investors, hold on to your seats. Prepare for shockwaves. The inflation-adjusted value of silver, compared with the 1980s peak, gives it a fair value of $142, and that's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation calculator. Central banks currently own about one-fifth of all the gold ever mined. They're expected to buy 350 tons more of the yellow metal, valued at $15 billion this year. That's according to the World Gold Council. Gold remains a key component of central bank portfolios, given that their money machinations bear the responsibility of unprecedented global inflation levels. Elsewhere, Russia's stock and currency exchange will introduce a deliverable gold and silver bar market this month. Following on the heels of China's very successful Shanghai Gold Exchange, leaders hope to increase the widespread diversification benefits to the populace. The contracts are expected to appeal to brokers, producers, jewelers, and private investors. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, the markets fell through the head and shoulders neckline this week, as anticipated for several weeks now in the Alpha Stocks newsletter. For next week's forecast and all the stock picks, please log into your Alpha Stocks account. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly cloudy skies appeared over the equities market. Investors picked up shares on the Dow and S&P, shunning the Nasdaq finally due to continued political wrangling in Washington. At the closing bell on the New York Stock Exchange, the Dow Jones Industrials rebounded 164 points, closing at 15,237, while the S&P 500 picked up 12, finishing at 1703, and the NASDAQ finally ended its winning streak, declining only 15 points and finishing at 3791. Meanwhile, rumors surrounding the government shutdown and debt ceiling standoff suggests that legislators could agree to increase the debt ceiling enough to extend operations another 6 weeks, hopefully enough time to craft a long-term solution. Most likely, Fed and Treasury officials are in contact with both the White House and Congress, making it clear the gravity of the impending debt default. Elsewhere, stock to watch, Transmontane Partners, TLP, continues to hold up well. According to DCF analysis, it's undervalued by about 100%, making it a potential portfolio candidate. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, according to the Market Sentiment Index, fear remains very high here, indicating that investors are overly bearish despite the positive price action. And of course, that's a positive from a contrarian perspective. For all of next week's stock picks and the forecast, log into your account. Coming up, more GoldSeek.com radio with James Turk and Gerald Celente. More edutainment is headed this way at the speed of thought. Stay with GoldSeek. As the U.S. government shutdown enters its second week here, and less than 10 days left to the debt ceiling, the U.S. could default on legal obligations, making the fall of even Lehman Brothers seem trivial. Joining me to discuss the implications of a sovereign debt default, Gerald Celente, the director of the Trends Research Institute. His team produces the Trends Journal. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
Let's delve into the minutiae of this U.S. debt limit, you know, including the total amount of money the U.S. government can borrow to meet its obligations, such as Social Security, Medicare, military salaries, interest on the national debt. Do you think that this is as big of a deal as some sources indicate?
Yeah, it is. It's a big deal. Not that they won't do it. Of course, they're going to have to do it at some point. But it's a big deal in the sense that, you know, this is another day and just another episode in the world of the incompetence and the inepts. And, you know, we've been going on with this thing for how long when you really think about it? We remember the fiscal cliff we were all going to fall off? And that went on for 2 years. And as it ended up, they downgraded, S&P did, they downgraded U.S. Credit worthiness back in August of 2011. You know, so this thing just keeps going on and on and on and on and on. And then look, we had sequestering, and now we have the shutdown, and now we have the debt ceiling. So what it's doing, it's causing destabilization in a marketplace that's already destabilized. There is no economy. Oh, I forgot tapering. How could I have forgotten tapering? You remember what that did to the markets. So yes, it's important in the context of the whole.
You make an important point as well that they're certainly going to save us from a debt default. But, you know, many folks claim that we would never see a government shutdown. And here we are, you know, almost 20% of the government, not a huge number, but still 15 to 20% of the government is technically shut down. Maybe they will enter debt default, and that would cause mayhem throughout the global financial system, including the stock and bond markets. Of course, we'd see interest rates soar, and then mortgage expenses would soar. That would crush the nascent housing recovery, putting downward pressure on our economic recovery.
You know, you're looking at a real unraveling of the entire global economic system, because when you look at countries such as China, I mean, what are they? They're holding on to about $1.3 trillion worth of U.S. debt, and Japan and all the others that are so heavily weighed by withholding U.S. debt. You know what this may also end up doing, by the way? It might also end up in a devaluation, official devaluation of the U.S. dollar. I mean, that's if it went to the extreme.
They have no other alternative. We're looking at a mountain of debt. Roughly $2 trillion between Japan and China are two largest holders of T-bonds and notes. $2 trillion would have to be somehow absorbed by the market. The market will not absorb it. It could not stand such a huge sea change. That forces the U.S. Treasury or the Fed or a combination thereof to absorb that $2 trillion. So it would essentially be the U.S. government forgiving its own debts. There's only one way for that to happen and the markets to remain solvent, a U.S. downgrade of the U.S. dollar, the greenback. Do you think we could see a 20-30% or more devaluation?
Well, the United States has done it before. Go back to 1933. The dollar was pegged to gold. And gold, it was pegged, what, at $20.62 an ounce. And then what happened? FDR called in all the gold. If you didn't bring it in, you went to jail. It got fined. And what happened? They sold it back to the government to $20.62 an ounce. And as soon as they got it all in, they repegged the dollar to gold to $35 an ounce. That means you just, they devalued the dollar. They, you just lost some 70% of your purchasing power. And that's the kind of way that they will do it. They won't do it straight out. In this case, they may. And you know, there's anything can happen. As you just saw what happened, that's you know, made the news, and everybody, you know, it's kind of gone over their head. The United States invaded two sovereign countries this past weekend, Libya and Somalia, to find the bad guys. I mean, what if Somalia or Libya, you know, they were heavily armed countries and substantial militaries, and they came into the United States and for looking for a person that they thought, you know, did something with no proof, but they're suspects and they want to question them. I mean, would America stand for it for one moment? No. And so what I'm saying is, the way things are going, we can have a traumatic geopolitical event occur that's going to get the people's minds off a lot of things, other than more so than a debt ceiling or a shutdown, because they could then blame this on somebody else, and then they could use that as a reason why we can't raise the debt ceiling in this time of crises. So, in other words, whatever they do, I don't think they're going to do it so blatantly. There'll be a covering around it of some sort to make it seem like it was a last resort measure.
The threat of debt default is jeopardizing the vestiges of our U.S. AAA debt status. And you did mention the S&P downgraded U.S. debt from AAA to AA. Fitch and Moody's, at last check, I believe, are still holding out with that AAA debt status. If we lose the stability, if that implodes, I think it could threaten, you know, at least that half quadrillion dollars worth of interest rate sensitive financial derivatives outstanding. And, you know, our top banks own about half of that. That comes to about a quarter of a quadrillion dollars worth of risk that you might say, well, it's just the banks. But really, we found out recently we're all on the hook for the banks. So is it really just the banks, or is it really we the people who owe this quadrillion dollars sitting on our major banks' balance sheets? And as I said, as that interest rates start to ratchet up, those securities, many of them, begin to implode. Any thoughts?
Yes, of course we the people. We pay for everything. Who bailed out the banks? You know, who bailed out those financial companies and auto companies? It's we the people. We get the tab on everything, and not only in the U.S., everywhere. Look what they've done in Greece and Spain and Ireland and Portugal and Italy. Look at the austerity measures in the U.K. They raised the taxes on the people across the board. Look at the facts. Where our median household income is below 1999 levels. And what do? Every city, state, everybody raises their taxes. Look what Obama did after promising not to raise taxes. What did he do? He raised taxes after the election. Look what it's done to retail, the payroll taxes, the little people. Look what's going on now with Obamacare. It raises a tax. I'm not calling it a tax. The Supreme Court called it a tax. So what's going to happen? Do the math. Everybody's being forced to buy insurance. And by the way, who are we buying? This is not socialized medicine. We're buying it from private companies. That's the merger of state and corporate powers. That's called fascism. So now tell me, what's going to happen to the money that people are being forced to buy insurance or being fined if they don't? What's that going to do to retail sales? So everything is going down. The debt level is going up. The crisis is forming. Who are they going to go after to pay for it? Who are they going after all the time? Us.
John Q. Public. Some folks are likening the Detroit bankruptcy as the, you might say, proverbial canary in the coal mine. You know, I think the typical American, if they've even thought about it, probably views it as an isolated event, sequestered, if you will, from the rest of the country. But we're starting to see this theme emerge. I mean, we're seeing Memphis up against the rope, Birmingham, Atlanta, of course, Detroit. And many other major cities, you know, a generation ago or 10, 20 years ago, this would be an unimaginable thought. Could the United States find itself in a Detroit-like situation? In fact, are we there now? Because on a per capita basis, we actually owe twice what the citizens of Detroit owed at their default. Any thoughts?
Yes, in the sense that I believe that many people know what's going on, because all you have to do is look around your own city or wherever you travel, and you could see the decline happening everywhere. I don't think people are oblivious to this. I think, yes, they think Detroit was a one-off in some sense, but in the other sense, hey, look over here in New York. I mean, what, the Metro North? You know, the rail line between New York and Connecticut, Stamford, Connecticut, you know, the traffic, that's one of the richest places around in business-wise, between Connecticut and New York City. I mean, the thing breaks down for a week. Anybody riding on a rail in the United States, you know, it's like a day in Calcutta. You know, go to Kennedy Airport after flying back, you know, from Norway or any of the Asian countries. You know, you think you flew back into the third world. Drive down the parkway. Look at all the garbage on the strewing the streets. So I think people see the breakdown. I think they're aware of the breakdown, and I also believe people won't be surprised if it breaks down. And I think that's why a lot of people are preparing. You know, there are still a lot of, you know, even though, you know, gold prices have softened somewhat, you know, as I've made very clear, and you know, unlike some of the other people, I'm not selling any gold in terms of, I mean, we're not a gold business. We're not a silver business. You have the Trends Journal. How many advertisements are in it? None. Not one. So we're not selling anybody's product. All we sell is information. And our information to sell has to be accurate. So I believe that's why you still have the preppers. That's why people are still into survivalism. And it's not declining. It's growing. And when you look around the world, by the way, look what's going on in Thailand. The people are buying gold like there's no tomorrow. Look what's going on in India. They're trying to do everything they possibly can, the Indian government, to stop the money from flowing out of the country and from stopping people to buy gold. Why? Because people know that their paper currencies are worthless because of what their governments are doing. Look at the Asian meeting this past week. Listen to all of them from Indonesia to China. They're all concerned about the economy. Look at the World Bank. They just downgraded Asian growth. So, yes, this whole thing is collapsing. But again, as a trend forecaster with the Globalnomic methodology, we look beyond the financial situation. And we're looking at geopolitics very heavily because we think that's going to be the wild card in the game. And I say that with a lot of confidence because you don't have to believe me on this one. Remember the Great Depression? Pearl Harbor made people forget about that one really quick.
We've seen this scenario unfold time and time again where difficult economic conditions, particularly global in scale, just seem to lead to world war. And historians have pointed out that this is not a coincidence. False flag situations, as you've just outlined, going back even way before World War II, fomenting the Spanish-American War. We mentioned that less than 20% of the government is currently shut down. But if more cuts do arise, given the U.S. government is the largest employer of American citizens, could we see an unemployment explosion? And what would that mean?
Well, yeah, the unemployment numbers probably will start going up again. And again, this thing is already having a major effect. I mean, import exports. I mean, you can't get anything coming into the country anymore because of the slowdown. And when I say anything, I mean a lot of they're not anything, but it was difficult enough before the inadequacies of the system, and now it's becoming even worse. No, this has wide implications. And what people, I believe, should start to consider and start admitting, they got a bunch of sociopaths who they call their senators, congressmen, commanders in chief. Be it Clinton, Bush, Obama, go down the line. And look what's going on now. This, again, and it's all connected, by the way, Chris. Look what's going on by Obama not going to the Asian conference. They can't pass through now the new trade bills that they're trying to push through. That's going to even have the United States people losing more jobs to cheap labor countries. So they're freaking out on that end as well, because they want to open up more so they could sell more. So this whole thing is all connected. So when you're talking about, already the people furloughed, it's having an effect on a lot of different areas and in a lot of different ways.
For generations, investors have been told that U.S. bonds were as safe as money in the bank. Even the mention of a default was considered impossible. However, that's changed markedly. Warren Buffett recently went on record. He likened a default to a nuclear bomb or an exchange of nuclear bombs, saying that it's too unthinkable to even contemplate. What does he know that the rest of us need to know?
I think he's saying everything that everybody's saying, actually. You've already said it. I mean, you've lined up the catastrophe that will happen with a debt default. And you pick up any newspaper, the Financial Times, Tuesday's Financial Times, front page. Pick up any of the newspapers in the business field. Go to any of the websites. This will be a catastrophe. And listen, if you were, the country, it kills the reserve currency, too, the United States. That one really unravels very quickly. But again, being a global nomic trend forecaster, I'm putting my bets that, number one, if they do default, it won't be a straight-out action of government inaction. There'll be a straw man that makes it look like it had to happen because of a geopolitical or some other kind of wild card issue that will get the people's mind off the ineptness and inability of Congress to deal with this. And even that they're getting away with dealing with this at this level for so long, to me, is an affront to this country, that we have such people that are so inconsiderate about the well-being of the nation.
A top bank noted recently that if the U.S. skips its interest payments on U.S. Treasury bonds, the S&P 500 equities market could lose nearly 50% alone this year. One media source claims that banks are also preparing their ATM machines with extra cash just in case a panic comes to pass. I would suspect they would very quickly run out of cash. Any thoughts?
Well, you mentioned before about Detroit being the canary in the mine shaft regarding bankruptcy. Just take a look at Cyprus. That, to me, was the canary in the mine shaft. That's what you can expect.
That threat of bail-ins, give it whatever moniker you like. Bail-ins, some folks just call it government confiscation. I mean, we're politely borrowing money from your wallet. But in the final analysis, we're seeing legislators include some really frightening verbiage in virtually every major industrialized nation. And I don't mean to sound alarmist, and it just seems like article after article. For instance, Poland, you may have read, essentially nationalized half of its pension funds. Said, I'm sorry, we're going to take 50% of your pension. Gone, just like that. And it's not just an isolated case. Lots of interesting clauses being written in and essentially putting the taxpayers on the hook for government-related profligacy.
Yes, and again, if there is a geopolitical reason behind it, they'll get away with it. These terrible terrorists have jeopardized the future of the United States. And because of these heinous acts, we are imposing, and it'll go on. They'll make up a story. The yellow ribbons will come out, the flags will wave, and 80% of the people will believe it. I want to give you a forecast. Here we are in October of 2013. In October of 1999, it's in the Trends Journal. Anybody could go to our website, trendsjournal.com. Go to our forecast page. It's right there. I said that there would be the dot-com meltdown by the second quarter of 2000. It happened in March. Remember, the NASDAQ was at 5,000, and it happened. I am forecasting there's going to be a great financial unraveling by March of 2014.
I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see something just as you've outlined there. You know, Gerald, there's another alarming trend we keep reading about in the United States, and this is something that I think that you would have your finger right on the pulse of, and that is in many states and municipalities, judges are tossing folks, everyday hardworking people, into debtor's prison. This is not just an isolated case. It violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. You know, only 150 years ago, around the 1840s and 50s, debtor's prisons were prevalent here in the United States, very common. And if the government can't balance its checkbook, how can the public be held responsible for its debts?
Well, you make a very good point. And let's expand even beyond that. Let's look at what's going on with this whole college fraud, where you have young people now getting out of school that were coerced into taking debt because they thought that they were going to get this degree and it was going to buy them a job. There's no way they could get out of the debt. They become indentured servants. It's very difficult to get out of the debt. There are other instances, for example, what also has happened. I mean, you know, this whole thing is a criminal act to me. I mean, you're 17, 18 years old. What do you know? You don't know anything. I know your kids are special and amazing, but for the rest of the 18 and 19-year-olds like I was or any of the other people, you know, you don't know what you're doing. And all of a sudden, your parents or grandparents are co-signing these loans for you. And now you're out of school and you can't find a job. Where are you going to get a job? Oh, Amazon's hiring 70,000 people for Christmas. Oh, great. That's going to be wonderful. Yeah, that'll pay you nothing. And so what we're looking at when you're talking about debt as prison, there's debt as prison and indentured servitude. And you know who you could thank for this, by the way? This began under the Clinton administration in the later years. I followed this very closely. And you know who was a big pusher behind this? Joe Biden. That's right. When he was senator of that loophole state. Yeah, well, the corporations are down there, you know, so you could get away with murder, literally. So what you're saying about putting people into debtor's prison and making them indentured servants, this is the new America. And, as I said, it's called fascism. It's the merger of state and corporate powers. This is not globalization, by the way. That's the other epiphany I've had. This is multinationalization. It's a multinational takeover. And so what they've done is they've made the laws so that you cannot get out of your debt one way or another. And by making these kids indentured servants, they're going to make sure that they get every penny that they want, plus they will draw blood from a stone. They'll do anything they can to get all they want and all they need because this is what's happened to America. And again, am I exaggerating? Look at the facts, Chris. The gap between the rich and the poor, the wealth gap, is more concentrated now than it has been in the last 100 years. Jimmy Carter this week said that the middle class today look like the poor of the 1970s.
Of course, we don't want to disparage higher education. You and I both are believers in how important that is. But you were right. If we look at debt-related secondary education has become a huge problem in excess of $1 trillion. And unfortunately, it's gone in far beyond even the inflation rate. We've watched this, you might even refer to it as a new bubble, a new financial bubble. So I think the best advice we could give to listeners who have kids or soon will have kids in school or are considering going to school outside of high school, if you will, is try to keep costs and expenses as low as possible and always be looking for internships. Hey, look for an internship at the Trends Research Institute. I mean, it's so important to try to, I think, gear your educational pursuits with a career path.
That's what I'm saying. And, you know, let's look at what's going on over here. You look at the America's K-12. It doesn't even win place or show compared to the rest of the world. The education system in this country's it's It's literally worthless unless you know how to navigate through it.
That's right. It's the navigation that's so important. And I really do believe that there are some incredible alternatives to the more traditional system. But and I think folks are starting to wake up to those alternatives. So let's hope that people will think twice for putting $30,000 to $50,000 a year.
I mean, who's making this stuff up? I got one for you. Let's do stocking shelves and shipping in and handling. Let's create a college course in that, because that's the only kind of jobs that people are getting these days, because they shipped all our jobs, all our technology, all our brain power to slave labor companies so they could get the highest return on their investment.
But I would want to encourage listeners to try to instill a passion for algebra and math and the sciences in their children and in their family, because this is where we're ailing. This is where we do need the most folks. I mean, I'm a huge fan of economics and business, but that's my background. I understand that's not for everybody. These are the areas that the jobs of the future will, the really fine jobs will be found. Maybe encourage your child to learn Latin. You know, they might become a doctor or a chemist. Is the language of science and medicine. Please don't let a child graduate from high school without at least 1 to 2 typing courses. It's the best gift you'll ever give them, because otherwise they're going to be paying their roommates and friends to type every paper they're going to have to type up in school and at work. So, you know, these are just a few simple things that I'm astounded that kids can graduate high school without having under their belts. Gerald, let me give you the last word here and share any other major themes or trends that you see developing that we haven't covered.
Well, during these times of uncertainty like this, I think it's very important to know where your money is. And if it's a bank holiday, it's not a holiday, man. You're not going to get your dough. And if you have certificates of deposit, if they close Wall Street, you won't be able to cash them out.
It'd be a certificate of confiscation, won't it?
Yeah, right. That, by the way, that's what happened on 9/11. You know, Wall Street was closed. You couldn't cash out your CDs. I know, because I tried. And so I think it's a very, very important right now to really know that you can get your hands on your money, because if there's a Cyprus kind of incident over here, guess what? You're not going to have any dough. And then you're also going to see, if that does happen, why it's valuable to have gold and silver in your possession, because you're going to be able to buy a lot with it, and probably more than on the dollar. So those are some things to consider. If you don't have your money, you don't have it. If it's in a bank, if it's in somebody else's hands, it's not in your hands. And in these times of economic uncertainty, when they're talking about, you know, debt ceiling and defaulting and government shutdowns and geopolitical strife, and I'm just saying, you better think twice, know where it is.
I want folks to try to wrap their minds around the thought, my silver coins aren't going to earn interest. If I leave it in a certificate of deposit, I can earn, 1 or 2%. What happens if you earn your 1 or 2%, but you never receive your money? Remember what Rogers used to say? I'm less concerned of the return on my money and much more concerned about the return of my money. And I think we're entering one of those periods of time. They don't come around but every few generations. But when they do, you'd better have something solid. You'd better crystallize everything you've spent a lifetime accumulating, because where we do see, as you mentioned, a Cyprus-like event, and everything that's not nailed down is gone.
That's right. You don't need any more proof than what's already happened. Oh, look what happened with MF Global when they went into segregated accounts.
That's right. Gerald Celente, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, our featured guest says that gold is in backwardation, at least recently, and the last two times that occurred marked the beginning of a powerful multi-year bull market rally, actually two of them. It's a pleasure to welcome James Turk, founder of GoldMoney.com and author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It. Welcome back, James Turk.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, the topic of gold and silver backwardation has caused a lot of confusion, I think. You'd probably agree in the gold crowd. You know, backwardation in the metals market is just counterintuitive, where investors are willing to pay more today than in the future for gold. So despite the storage costs and related issues and fees, investors are desperate for gold right now. Now, you point out that this is a rare occurrence that has only happened two times since the bull market began in 99, and each prior occurrence lasted only a few days. This time, it persisted much longer. Roughly 2 months were backdated this time around, as opposed to a day or two, maybe three, in the prior two instances. It seems as though something big might be stirring behind the scenes there.
Yeah, I agree, Chris. You know, you brought up the point about there being a little bit of confusion about backwardation. There are really two types of backwardation. There's backwardation in commodities, which happens quite a bit. And then there's backwardation in gold, which is a very, very rare event. You know, to view it properly, you have to accept the notion that gold is money. And it is money because it's accumulated. Gold's usefulness comes from the ability to use it in economic calculation. In other words, measuring prices over long periods of time. And because gold is a tangible asset, it doesn't have any counterparty risk. In other words, it's not based on some bank's or some government's promise. It has a very different risk profile than any national currencies. And because it has a different risk profile, it has a very low rate of interest. And as a consequence of that, gold is always in contango, which is the opposite of backwardation. In theory, gold should never go in backwardation because an arbitrageur will come and sell the spot and buy it back in the future at a cheaper price, as you mentioned. But because it didn't happen for such a long period of time, the only thing we can conclude from that is that at you know, prices that prevailed in the summer, there was a shortage of physical metal. And just like there was back in 1999 and 2008, the other two times there was significant backwardation. And both those moments led to a big rally in gold. I think we're going to see a big rally in gold here. But, you know, time will tell. You know, I'm a believer that, you know, you just keep accumulating it every month because this is a major bull market that's got a long time to go before it plays itself out.
You also point out that a shortage or tightness of supply in gold can only be relieved from the existing above-ground stockpiles. The only way for that, of course, to happen is for gold price or the gold price to rise high enough to entice people into exchanging their physical metal for dollars, which is what we did see the last two times that gold was backward dated. Do you think we're seeing that unfold here as well?
Yeah, another point that's related to this backwardation we had in the summer, you know, the low was over 3 months ago. We've been in a slow but steady uptrend over the past three and a half months since the lows were made. And I think that's quite significant. And, you know, I don't think people are paying attention to, you know, the fact that gold is, you know, basically being accumulated and being accumulated on a steady basis. And it's been forming a huge base, and it's typically a base like this which will cause the gold price to rise. Now, there have been some interesting events taking place. Obviously, the debt limit is an issue. I do believe that the debt ceiling is going to be increased, and when that happens, it's probably going to unleash a flood of new money printing from the Federal Reserve, particularly since we have a very dovish Federal Reserve chairman coming in a few months. So, you know, we're going to see more quantitative easing, more government deficits, more debt, and more debasement of the dollar, which ultimately means, you know, a higher gold price. The higher gold price has to come out of a backwardation because, in contrast to paper currencies, which could be created in an instant by a computer stroke or a bookkeeping entry, you know, gold comes the hard, old-fashioned way by, you know, hard work mining it and bringing it in above ground. You can't create it out of thin air. So the price has to rise to entice people who presently own gold to eliminate the backwardation. So, yeah, any way you look at it, Chris, from a tactical point of view, that, you know, the low was made 3 months ago and we're in an uptrend. The fact that we're forming a huge base, you know, all my measures indicate that gold's cheap. You've got the news out there, which is very gold positive. I'm pretty optimistic here as we move toward the end of the year.
You know, that's such an interesting point. In the final analysis, I mean, gold is not like grain or cotton or any other agricultural commodity. It has a finite amount. I mean, there is only so much gold and silver in the world, very labor and energy intensive process extracting and refining the ore.
Exactly. And the other thing, Chris, is that in contrast to these other commodities that you mentioned, those commodities like grain and soybeans and crude oil, they get produced but then are immediately consumed and disappear. Gold, on the other hand, is the only thing we humans produce that is accumulated. and all of the gold mined throughout history still exists in its above ground stock. That's what makes gold as money, the fact that it is accumulated. We hold it in different forms. It's fabricated into bars. It's fabricated into high carat jewelry. It's fabricated into coins. But regardless of the reason, regardless of how it's fabricated, the reason that you hold it is always the same, because it's money. It's a store of value. It's preserved purchasing power for thousands of years, and it's likely to continue to preserve purchasing power in the future, come what may, in terms of central bank actions or central planning actions with regard to the dollar or any other currencies around the world. So it is the go-to asset at this moment in time, even though the price has been lackluster.
You know, you talk about gold being accumulated over history, and of course, just take a look at the year 1900. There was probably less than a billion people in the world. There's now seven times at least as many. If we look at the total money supply, just over the past 20, 30 years, a factor of so many fold higher. So the gold remains, for the most part, constant and steady, whereas the number of people in need of gold and the number of dollars chasing gold has skyrocketed. One caveat, though, here regarding the backwardation concept before we move on. You know, the previous two did mark the lows and explosive bull markets did commence. But I'd like for listeners, before they, you know, run out and buy 2014 and 2015 options on gold and silver and make all these speculative moves. In 1999, it did require nearly 2 years before the bull market took off. And I think you could argue that the reason why it required so much time after the backwardation event, well, there were so many skeptical investors following many years of disappointing action in the markets. And it takes us to 2008. As soon as the backwardation came to pass, it really marked the lows and we took off to the races. Well, folks had regained a lot of their confidence and were less skeptical regarding the markets. And I just wanted to throw that in there. That doesn't necessarily mean we will see new highs, let's say, in the next year or two.
Yeah, and you raise another important point, Chris, that, you know, there are two types of gold. There's physical gold, which is a tangible asset. It doesn't have counterparty risk. And then there's paper gold. And paper gold is a financial asset, and it comes with counterparty risk. And there are various types of paper gold. You know, there are options, there are futures, there are ETFs, there are, you know, pool accounts, there are certificates. You have to ask yourself, why are you buying gold in the first place? Are you buying it because it's a safe haven? Well, if it's a safe haven, then you want to own physical gold because it doesn't have counterparty risk. But if you're buying it to try trading and profiting from fluctuations in the gold price, well, then you can look at paper gold, you know, futures, ETFs, options, or whatever. But, you know, that's an entirely different game. And what I talk about when I talk about gold is physical gold, and, you know, why people need to acquire physical gold, because it is a safe haven. It's an important diversifier in everyone's portfolio.
You know, another interesting way to view the market, I think, is through the consumer price index. And if you juxtapose gold against gold, must climb at least 4 to 5 times to roughly $5,000 an ounce just to meet that 1980s inflation adjusted peak. And I know that many subscribers and listeners and readers are aware of this. Even this lofty target that doesn't compensate for the much higher debt levels and greater demand, not to mention access to the metal in 2013 as compared to 1980. Any comments?
No, it's some good observations, and it sort of makes me think here about the circumstances that we're in. You know, I really think we're resting on a knife edge. You know, confidence in fiat currency, currency backed by nothing except government promises, is a very fragile thing. And we know from monetary history that in many, many countries around the world, that confidence in currency backed by nothing can vanish essentially overnight. And when it does, at the end of the day, your position is going to, your financial position is not going to be measured in how much currency you have, but how many ounces you own. And I think, you know, really that's where we're heading. You know, it's this debate over the debt ceiling, you know, Chris, that, you know, the debt ceiling is there. It's supposed to impose discipline on the government to quit, you know, borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, and then having the Federal Reserve buy all that government debt and turn it into currency. You know, that is the path to currency debasement and ultimately the path to hyperinflation. We're seeing the currency debasement because of inflation and the fact that the dollar doesn't purchase the same thing it purchased a year ago or even 6 months ago because of because of inflation. And, you know, we're on this path, and we have to get off this path to go back to sound money. And in the assumption that governments are not going to get off this path, we, each individual, have to be cognizant of the fact that we have to take those steps to protect ourselves and our family. And the way to do that is to diversify your portfolio in as many ways as possible, and owning physical precious metals, be it gold or silver, is an ideal way to do that. It's got the historical proven track record, you know, 5,000 years of history of money. It didn't stop being money 40 years ago just because the president said so. It continues to be money, which is why things like backwardation are very, very rare when it occurs. You know, gold has an interest rate, just like dollars have an interest rate, and gold interest rates are always supposed to be lower than dollar interest rates. But because of the interventions we're seeing in the market in so many different areas, including interest rates, you're getting all kinds of unusual things developing, but ultimately we're going to go back to basics, and gold is going to be at the center of commerce, in my view, once again.
Exactly. And, you know, you mentioned diversification. The only free lunch, it's been called, in the investing world, that asset class that balances portfolio betas, a recent correlation matrix, gold against equities. And it turns out that gold is almost 75% negatively correlated with the New York Stock Exchange, even more so than the S&P 500, which surprised me. You can't own a stock without owning some gold. If you do, well, you're jumping out of the plane without a parachute.
Yeah, I liked your, I saw your chart, and I liked it a lot. And I think the point you're making is a very valid one.
And I'd also like to discuss your long-term silver chart, indicating a large parabola. 35-year overview shows that $50 peak in 1980 against the recent $50 or so peak in 2011. One of the most reliable patterns in not only engineering but throughout finance is the head and shoulder. And this just looks, I think, eerily similar to a reverse head and shoulder, one of my favorite bottoming patterns, very reliable, and it's quite prevalent in the markets.
Yeah, I describe it as a big accumulation pattern, and there are different ways you can describe that accumulation pattern. Head and shoulders is one way of doing it. I tend to use the description of a cup and handle. You know, the cup was made between the 50 back in 1980 and $50 back in 2011. And what we've been forming now is a little handle. And when we go back above $50, that base will have been complete. And then, you know, we head much higher from there, just based on normal technical analysis. But, you know, again, these things don't happen overnight, which is why I keep going back to my basic premise. You know, just keep accumulating physical metal, because we're in a major bull market. Don't get shaken out by the noise or the ups and the downs, you know, this week or that month or whatever. Just play it from a long-term point of view, and fit precious metals within your portfolio is an important diversifier.
I think it's well said, and I'd only add one little point here, but one of the neatest aspects that I think some analysts overlook is that these patterns have a wonderful tendency to give you a forward estimate of the next peak. So, for instance, let's say that we're looking at $4 low on silver, and let's say a $50 high. Well, if we take the neckline there on the cup and handle or the head and shoulders, I mean, you can extrapolate forward roughly $46. And that gets us in the neighborhood of $100 per ounce. That doesn't necessarily mean that's the zenith of the bull market. That would be a target level for folks to maybe assume that things have gotten a bit frothy. These precious metals markets have a tendency, if we look back over the last 100 years of economic data, to just go parabolic and never look back. Weimar being, I guess, one of the best examples. One mark cost exactly $1 in 1916, 1917. And by 1923, the mark devalued by $1 trillion per gold coin. As we wrap up here, one quick note. Janet Yellen, of course, has accepted the head of the Federal Reserve position when Dr. Bernanke steps down in 2014. And I wanted to see if you had any comments on this event, particularly in how it may relate to the precious metals markets and the fact that Dr. Yellen is known as being quite dovish in her stance on monetary policy.
Yeah, I've read a lot of the material about her background and, you know, some of her comments in various FOMC meetings. And, you know, I agree with the consensus view here that she is very, very dovish. But, you know, back in 1971, when the dollar's link to gold was broken, we went in the wrong direction. we're paying the consequences of that now. And the Fed is stuck. You know, the Fed is on a treadmill, and it's starting to move faster and faster. And the being dovish, Janet Yellen is going to move even faster still. To try to keep interest rates down, try to revive the economy. But it doesn't work. What you need to revive the economy is less government involvement in the economy, less central planning, less control of interest rates. What's happening now, this zero interest rate policy, you're destroying capital. You're destroying the backbone of society, which is the middle class, which is where the capital is accumulated in a sound money system and where the production and hard work, you know, really appears or is illustrated. And because they're destroying the backbone of capitalism with these policies, the only people are benefiting from it are Wall Street. And this is ultimately going to lead to disaster, not unlike what happened to the first currency of the country, the Continental, which collapsed because it wasn't backed by anything but government promises, too. One of the reasons why the framers created a new the Constitution is to basically establish a sound money, and gold and actually silver initially, and then subsequently gold. Gold and silver were the backbone of it, and it worked well until 1971. We're experiencing now the same policies, the same problems that the framers of the Constitution experienced with the Continental. It's quite tragic. And, if you read the Constitution, it's quite clear. Congress has the ability to coin money. It does not have the authority to print money. The framers must be spinning in their graves given the monetary system we have in this country today.
Madison and Jefferson would say, do you not recall we both warned of precisely this? They'd be astounded at just how long, spanning from 1971 now, I guess we're going on 42, 43 years that this experiment with fiat money actually survived and thrived. I think they'd be surprised that we made it this long. Please tell folks more about goldmoney.com.
Yeah, gold money is a great way to buy and store precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, palladium. We have 23,000 customers, almost $2 billion of customer assets that we're safeguarding, which is stored in vaults in five different countries, Canada, the UK, Switzerland, Hong Kong, and Singapore.
Very good. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Chris. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. What's the big news this week? Is it that Republican leaders met with Obama for 90 minutes and agreed to keep talking about the U.S. debt limit? No. The one thing politicians actually do well is talking. The problem is they rarely say or do anything that's actually worth listening to. Is the big news this week that the White House responded to this charade by saying the president looks forward to making continued progress with members on both sides of the aisle? No. The aisle that divides left and right is an imaginary line that divides two sides of the same coin. Two sides of the same financial policy, money printing. The distinction that is presented as some kind of legitimate difference to voters is where that printed money gets spent. However, the root of this particular evil is the origin of most of those dollars, the printing press. Which means your future production, which means your children and your grandchildren's future efforts will go to earn the money that is being created as debt today. Or is the big news this week a study by a group of economists from the IMF that plays with the idea to initiate a super tax of 10% on savings accounts throughout the Eurozone. Supposedly, as an alternative to tax increases and spending cuts. But wait a minute. Haven't savers already been punished enough by double and triple taxation on the money they have been able to squirrel away into a savings account? This idea is being marketed as a one-time tax that is somehow supposed to be fair. Once a government gets a taste for a new source of tax revenue, when have they ever let it go? If the Eurozone tries this, how long will it be until other countries try the same? The insatiable appetite of governments to spend and tax and avoid cuts of any kind always lead them to new and imaginative forms of confiscation, usually by targeting select groups or industries through taxation. And when the confiscation casts a wide net that impacts the masses, it is sold as being fair. Or do all of these examples lead us to what is truly the big news of the week that has remained largely hidden and underreported? And that is China's call for a new international reserve currency. As Beijing's central bank governor says, to overhaul a global financial system dominated by the dollar and Western governments. The U.S. and the European Union brushed off the idea. However, the essay that discussed this proposal was published in both Chinese and English, a move designed to garner much more of an international audience. But in reality, this is not a new idea. Back in 2009, former Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner addressed the Council on Foreign Relations, where he was asked about the Chinese government's proposal at that time for a global currency. Geithner described the Chinese proposal as a means to increase the use of the International Monetary Fund's Special Drawing Rights, or SDRs, which is represented by a basket of currencies. Geithner said, "We're actually quite open to that suggestion." So today, the U.S. and the European Union are brushing off the idea, and Geithner said in 2009 we're actually open to that suggestion? As in all political doublespeak, it is and it isn't at the same time. Is it any coincidence that most major countries throughout the world are engaged in their own form of quantitative easing? Isn't it likely that many of those countries will get into financial trouble and beyond the point of no return within the same window of time? Isn't it possible that a global solution will be required to fix the problem? One with fabricated compromises to solve what will be labeled as major differences of opinion? Kind of like the debt ceiling debate in Washington? We already know how the story is going to end. It's just a question of how the story, the debate, and the hard-won solution and compromise is going to be sold to us. And believe me, it is going to be sold. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.